GTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW-Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, vice president for community and government relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, and welcome to WGTD's Education Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, and I'm very pleased to present my guest, Dr. Wendy Leeds-Hurwitz, Professor Emerita of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Wendy earned her MA and PhD at the University of Pennsylvania, and then at UW-Parkside, she taught for 28 years. She's also associate faculty at Royal Roads University in Canada. Wendy is currently director of the Center for Intercultural Dialogue. She's held a variety of visiting positions in Paris and Lyon, France, Coimbra, Portugal, Beijing, and Macau, China. She has published over a dozen books, becoming known for work in intercultural communication, social interaction, social construction theory, semiotic theory, the ethnography of communication, and disciplinary history. Wendy's interested in how people construct meanings for themselves and others through interaction, how cultural identity is constructed and maintained, and how conflicting identities or meanings can be conveyed simultaneously. She studies disciplinary history to learn why scholars examine particular topics in specific ways, and she often stops to consider particular research methods or theories. She always takes an interdisciplinary approach to problems. So welcome, Wendy Leeds-Hurwitz.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan.
Yeah, it's a lovely opportunity to connect and also to let the world know some of the wonderful work that you do. I had talked to you just prior to this conversation, and we'd been thinking about places to begin, and I think we agreed that a wonderful place to begin would be how your retirement came about. This is part of the educational career, and maybe it's not talked about enough. So how did you end up retiring?
Well, this is an interesting story. It's a very long story. I will try to make it short. Otherwise, we'll spend the entire time just talking about this. I was at an event at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences in 2008, and I said to a colleague who was then working in France that I thought this was absolutely marvelous and I would love to do something like that. And he said, oh, you know, my university is going to be starting an Institute for Advanced Studies next year. I have nothing to do with it, but at least I could tell you when the applications can go in. So I put in an application and I got it, and I spent 6 months in 2009 in Lyon in France as a senior fellow at the Collegium de Lyon, which is an institute for advanced studies. And what that means is they draw in a bunch of faculty from other countries, some French, mostly international, and give you an enormous amount of time in order to do whatever you want. Mm. I worked with various colleagues and also doctoral students, and one of the things I discovered was just how well connected everybody was internationally. Not just the way I was connected, which is I would see people at conferences, but in terms of being part of major research projects, and I was very impressed by that, and I thought, I need to do something different when I go back home. Hmm. And then between that and going back home, I had co-organized a conference in Istanbul with a colleague in Turkey on the topic of intercultural dialogue. Mm. And we brought in people from around the world, a couple of dozen people, and it was supported by a couple of American associations and mostly the National Communication Association, also by her university. And at the end of it, people said, because I gave them one panel slot in order to figure out what do you want to do next. And basically what they said is, we want you to figure out some way for all of us to stay in touch. So I went back home with both of these two things rattling around in my brain. One was I wanted to do more internationally myself. And the other was that other people I now knew, I had known some of them before the event, but many not, wanted me to do something to set up some way for them to stay in touch and do things collaboratively, even though they were coming from an awful lot of different places, whether disciplines or countries or research interests. And then I came back home to UW Parkside, and I discovered that it can be difficult to go from working with doctoral students to working with undergraduates. And so it was a little bit of a shock to my system that I was having more problems than I was used to with students doing things like never even showing up once. I had gotten good at working with students who showed up and didn't quite know if they wanted to come back, but I had never had so many students never show up at the first day of class or ever after. And I was distraught. I didn't know what to do with that. And then all of this is about the first week of class. I suddenly get an invitation to return to France. And so I went to Human Resources and I said, when do I get to retire? I have not been here 30 years. I am not 62. When do I get to retire? And they said, oh, you can retire anytime. It won't make any difference in your retirement pension because we can tell you right now, you're not getting any raises the next few years. It's not going to go up. So you can retire now. So I did. I retired at the end of that academic year to give the department some notice to replace me. And I went back to France. And then I followed up a variety of opportunities that had grown out of either being in France initially or having now this mandate to do something to keep people in touch. What I ended up doing is starting the Center for Intercultural Dialogue, which exists only online. There is no physical in real life version of it. But I wanted to give a place for people to come together and share resources, talk to each other, do things in common. So I started that. But I also followed up a variety of connections made while I was in France. One of the interesting things is that almost immediately when I got to France, somebody at the UN in Geneva found me and somebody at UNESCO in Paris found me. I have to say that never happened when I was in Wisconsin. Nobody ever came looking for me from major international organizations like that. And so those connections facilitated other connections. And really the short version of what happened is that it was a concatenating series of connections. One person leading me to the next person, leading me to another person. So for example, when my husband who was with me while we were in France, each time he had retired early also, and so he could do his work from home, except home was wherever we were. But keep doing some work as well. And so we took a break from France and we went to Portugal. Well, somebody I met at a UNESCO event immediately introduced me to somebody in Portugal and said, oh, you're going to have things in common you need to meet. So we met. And then not only did we discover we had an awful lot of things in common, but purely by chance, because this is, I was not working on education specifically when I was in France the first time, and that's when I met her, turned out she was the director of a Center for Teaching Excellence. And I had been a teaching fellow in the UW system in the 80s, and had the second time I was in France, I ended up co-authoring a book with somebody who'd also been at Parkside, Peter Hoff, who'd gone on to become the president of the University of Maine, and by then had retired and was an interim president in Georgia, of a university in Georgia. And so we ended up writing a book on education called Learning Matters, which was done because my second visit in France, the invitation back, was to work with what is essentially the National Institute of Education in France. The physical home was in Lyon, and somebody I knew from my first visit there thought I might have something interesting to contribute. And the goal was to figure out what did Americans do in terms of pedagogical changes that had not yet gotten to France and then later to Portugal that might be interesting to share. And so first I spent 6 months working with people in Lyon, and we ended up writing this book and then sharing that, giving a bunch of talks, working with small groups, that sort of thing. And then the next year, by then it was 2012, I worked in Portugal as a Fulbright, because they put in for me, I put in that I was interested, and Fulbright made the match and covered the expenses. And I spent 6 weeks at the Polytechnic University in Coimbra, which was very, well, small and less prestigious than the University of Coimbra. And so they'd never had a Fulbright. So they were immediately approved to have somebody. And I worked with their Center for Teaching Excellence and gave a series of presentations to the faculty there. We worked with different colleges and did something unique. Basically, I put together a list and said, these are things I know something about. Does any of this interest you? And everybody picked a different topic. And then I gave a talk on each of the topics that different colleges had picked. And that was fascinating. I can tell you stories about some of that if you would like, or I can keep going and give you different responses to keep on with different things. But one of the things they wanted to do was to take this book on learning matters and translate it into Portuguese. So they did that. And so a version of it, which is substantially changed because it was a different audience, also was then published in Portuguese. And that was because in France, the argument had been keep it in English because none of these terms make any sense. They don't exist in French yet. But in Portugal, it was, no, the faculty at the Polytechnic can't be assumed to know English well enough. We need to translate it into Portuguese. So it was interesting that in one place it got translated, in one place it didn't. So at the same time, I started doing a lot of traveling to follow up a lot of connections. And I was thinking about it before we started talking, trying to think about how did I end up at some of these places? Because we did 5 years of round-the-world trips where we stopped in about a dozen different countries for shorter or longer periods. And I gave talks. I taught a graduate seminar for a couple of weeks. I did all sorts of things, mostly lots of talks, worked with people, co-organized a conference in Macau at one point. And what happened is that somebody I knew from one context, usually a conference, would invite me to come and give a talk. And that was standard. That's how it works. But then they would, in talking with them, they would say, oh, I know this person in China, and you're telling me you might have an interest in going to China sometime. And you might know other people there. So if you do that, let me introduce you to this person I know. And so somebody I met at a conference in the U.S., he was based in Northern Ireland and had me there giving a talk. And then he introduced me somebody who used to be on their faculty who had gone back to China and was now in China, who then had me come and give a talk at Zhejiang University in Hangzhou. And so that's how it happened. And sometimes it was more immediate. Somebody who I had met because I was mentoring her at an event. Senior faculty were asked to work with junior, with actually advanced doctoral students at a conference. This was again in the U.S. She was from Japan. She found out I might be going to Japan. I learned to write a note saying, I might be in your country. Can we connect? And then somebody I knew would write back and say, let's do this. And so she invited me to give a talk at her university. Apparently, she mentioned to somebody she knew in Okinawa at the University of the Ryukyus that she got me to come to her university. And he said, well, I want her to come to mine too. We are talking, I don't know, it was something like a 7-hour flight. So it was not nearby. But I also got invited to the University of the Ryukyus and spent several days there working with their faculty and their graduate students and giving a couple of talks. And that was fascinating. I still do not understand how they put, I think it was 200 or 300 students in a room on very short notice. China, the same. I really don't understand how they do that. I don't think you could do that in the U.S. But setting up large talks, very, very quickly with enormous attendance for somebody coming. Now, what made all of this possible is the fact that I published a lot. So a lot of these people recognized me as somebody who had written a book they wrote. Now, sometimes that worked in really odd ways. So in fact, when I gave that talk in Zhejiang University, somebody came up to me afterwards, a faculty member, and said, I don't understand. Why are you talking about the history of intercultural communication? You wrote a book on intercultural weddings and how people managed to put together different cultural identities for the same ritual. That's what I thought you would obviously talk about, because that's what I know you've written. And I've got this graduate student here who needs to talk to you about that. So I spent a few hours talking with her about that. But so it was very funny when I would show up and I was asked to talk about one thing, but like most faculty, I had done multiple things in my career. And so again, this is after 30 years of teaching and publishing. So there were many, many things I had done. The fact that I had done a little bit of research on college for kids in the US, in France, they'd never heard of anything like that, and they were absolutely fascinated by it. And some of the people at their National Institute of Education wanted to hear about that. The fact that I had run the freshman seminar program at Parkside for a couple of years, working on how to help students bridge the gap, especially first generation college bound like Parkside gets so much of, that was something very new to most of the audiences I was talking about. They were very interested in that. The fact that I had run the senior seminar, I had taught senior seminar for years in our communication program, and I had developed particular ideas about how to help students synthesize what they had learned, how to help them apply what they had learned in practical projects in the community, and how to put together an e-folio documenting what they had done, but learning what in the early 2000s was still some technology they weren't used to using. And they had to learn some things. They had to teach me some things. And so we were all learning together. Those were all things that nobody at any of the universities abroad were doing anything about. Capstone courses were not yet standard anywhere outside the U.S., and they still didn't exist at lots of places in the U.S. Freshman seminar programs didn't exist anywhere. The kind of take what you've learned in a university course and apply it, that was not common in most universities. I still remember one of the talks I gave to, it was the School of Engineering and Math at this polytechnic in Coimbra. And I was they wanted me to talk about how to get students to come to class because students were not required to attend there. And they were discovering that by 2012, many students were not showing up. They were reading the book, they were taking the final exam, and they were passing. And the faculty didn't like this. They thought they ought to show up in class as well. So we talked that through, and I said, you know, you need to be doing something in the classroom that they don't get outside of the classroom. And then you need to do something with what they've learned as a group so they apply what they've learned. And I specifically remember using an example from somebody who'd written an article at UW-Madison about how for math, he had sent students out to measure what kind of insulation people in the community had and use math to figure out how much more insulation they needed in the winter to stay warm and what would be appropriate. And the students had to use these elaborate formulas that they had to learn, and the community members were thrilled. And I remember that some of the faculty in Coimbra had never heard of doing anything like that. They thought that was completely bizarre. But a couple of them then seriously changed the way they were teaching as a result. Wonderful. So these are some of the examples of things that I was doing. I haven't yet talked about the center. Maybe we should do that after we get to a break.
Sure. Yes, this would be a good time for a break. So you're listening to WGTD FM. I'm your host, Jonathan Shaler. This is Education Matters, and we're speaking with Wendy Leeds Hurwitz, Professor Emerita of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Parkside. We've just been talking about what happened when Wendy retired, how she came about that decision and what proceeded from that. And now we're going to be talking about an institution that she developed, the Center for Intercultural Dialogue. How did that come about, Wendy?
So after the conference in Istanbul, people wanted to stay in touch. And so after the conference was over, I brought together several of the most senior people in the room who were the presidents of the National and the International Communication Association. I had specifically invited them to attend this event. And I said to them, what do I do next? Talk to me about how we're going to make something happen. And one of the people there said, well, why don't you bring a proposal to the Council for Communication Associations? And I said, I've never even heard of that. What is that? And the answer is, it's an organization that was started initially by three communication associations, AEJMC, which is Journalism and Mass Comm, and the International and the National Communication Associations. They realized that they had some, I don't know exactly anymore because I wasn't there at that time, but a couple of those groups had scheduled their conferences for the same week. And that's dreadful because there's always overlapping membership in these associations. And if you set up your events at the same time, you lose people from your event and nobody wants to do that. So one of the then presidents said, well, we need to talk to each other. Let's set up a group that's going to coordinate. And that's the council. And the council then took on doing a number of projects that put forward things that all of the associations in the discipline of communication would share. And so they talked to organizations and government branches in DC on behalf of the associations. They sometimes talk to publishers on behalf of the associations. So they do a variety of coordinating activities. And so I said, okay, now that I understand what this is reasonable. I put together a proposal. They invited me to speak. And I went to Washington, D.C. during their next event. And in spring of 2010, just about the time I was retiring, I went there. They approved the idea. They said, okay, you've got until our fall meeting to put together some documentation for this center. You have to now design a center. And I sort of went, oh, my God, I don't know how to do that. But I did lots of research. I worked with several staff members at UW Parkside and got advice, talked to people who had established centers, talked to somebody in France I had met who was establishing his own institute and worked on what would be common and what needed to change and put something together. And then that became real. So by the fall of 2010, I was named director of the Center for Intercultural Dialogue, and I started a website. And then a couple of years later, let's see, when I was in Australia giving a talk in Brisbane, somebody I knew there said, oh, you need a Facebook group. You don't just need a website. I had started a website, and they asked me to do it on WordPress because that's what the council was using at the time. So I had to learn. I didn't know anything about WordPress. I had to learn how to design a website and put that together. And I did. And then he said, oh, you need a Facebook group. People need to be able to find you if they don't just find the website. So he helped me create a Facebook group. And then I was in a visiting position at Villanova University. I was the Heron Chair in Communication. And they gave me a master's level student as my assistant for the semester. And she said, well, you know, Facebook's all very well and good. But first of all, you need a different kind of Facebook group. The world has moved on. It's a, you know, 2 years later, you need to do something different. So she designed a different kind of Facebook group and we started that over. She designed a LinkedIn group. Mm-hmm. She designed a couple of others, including some things that are like Pinterest, which is not terribly active at this point. So we ended up letting it lapse. We had something on Twitter for many years. We ended up when Twitter turned into X and all I was seeing was a lot of garbage. We got off that. But so now we have, people can subscribe to the center on WordPress. They can subscribe via the Facebook group or via the LinkedIn group. And we've got about 4,500 people around the world. Mm. More of them are based in the U.S. than anywhere else. but the vast majority are international. More of them are based in communication than anything else, but the vast majority are not. More of them are academics than anything else, but the vast majority are practitioners of various sorts. And so what happened is it's a way of bringing people together. And depending on whether something I propose or somebody else propose goes anywhere and gets picked up and gets any input, that's what we do more of. If it doesn't go anywhere and doesn't get any input, then we don't do much more of it. So for example, the single most useful thing we've ever done, according to who downloads what, is to prepare something called Key Concepts in Intercultural Dialogue. And this is something I invented because right after the center was started, back in the days when I was still going to conferences routinely, somebody said to me, I don't even know what intercultural dialogue is supposed to be. You'd better do something on your website to explain it to people like me who get there because they know who you are but haven't got a clue what this topic is. So I started the Key Concepts in Intercultural Dialogue. That was 2014, I think, when we started it. We now have 111. The 111th just went up. They're one page. They're very short. And after a couple of years, somebody said to me, I'm in Colombia and I would like this one in Spanish. Would I have your permission to translate it? And I said, not only do you have my permission, I want to publish it. So let's revise the template, you know, give it a heading in Spanish, you do the Spanish part, and I'll publish it, and then you'll get more viewers, and that way you can use it for your students. And so we did that. At this point, I don't even know what the number is. It's something close to 36 languages. Mm. People just come out of the woodwork and write to me and say, I would like this in Arabic, or I would like this in Turkish, or I would like this in Persian. And I did learn very quickly that I need to have translations reviewed. I serve as editor, and so I review the English. I've published enough that I'm very comfortable serving as copy editor and proofreader. But I can't do all these other languages. The only one I know is French. Mm-hmm. And my French isn't good enough for me to proofread and copy edit in French because I don't need to read and write it often enough. So I needed a series of reviewers. And I learned that because I had graduate students who were given an assignment by a colleague, and she did tell me she was doing this. I thought it was fine. And then when I accepted the first of their translations and I published it, somebody immediately wrote to me and said, this was done on Google Translate and you can't use it. It's awful. So I went, oh dear, now I'm in trouble. Mm-hmm. And so I established a process whereby every translation is immediately reviewed by somebody who is fully bilingual in the relevant languages and who knows something about the content. Mm. And that can sometimes be hard to find, but people have been wonderful about doing it. Mm. And there's a bunch of other publications, but this one, I have to tell you, I put together a six-month report for the council every 6 months. That was redundant. And I tell them each time which parts of the website are getting the most attention. So I can tell you that 10 different publications got over 1,000 downloads in the last 6 months. Some of them are not what you would assume. So there's a translation into Persian that got 7,000 downloads.
Wow.
And it absolutely astounds me when this sort of thing happens. But what it means is apparently two things. One is there's not a lot out there on the internet with some of the vocabulary words I've got or translated into some of the languages we've got. And the other part of it is that because I've been posting every day since 2011, sometimes a bit more. Sometimes I have extra job ads and I post a couple on the weekend instead of one each day on the weekend. Because all the links are to legitimate websites, and there's a lot of links on there to things like other centers with comparable interest, profiles of people who do relevant things. There's all sorts of links out there to real websites, and there's no ads. We pay to make sure there's no ads. And so apparently all of those things means that Google likes, or other search engines like, the website, like the content on the website, and therefore put it higher up. So in this case, not having ads is the way to get higher up in the chart and means that more people find what we're doing. So at this point, I've got a whole bunch of different publications. I've got a whole, I just counted it for somebody. I've got over 250 profiles of people around the world who have taken the time to do something, write a publication, write a translation. We were asked by UNESCO to be part of some group discussions about education internationally, and all the people who joined any of those discussion groups were just starting expert groups, again, at request. That wasn't something I came up with, but we were trying to do it. We, for a while, we did videotapes by students, and they got to illustrate particular topics. One of them was, what is intercultural dialogue? And so we got really interesting visual examples that people chose to record and put up there. And they got credit usually within a class. So we've done lots and lots of different things over the years. One of the things that amazes me at this point is that we're still around, but most of the organizations who I list in relevant organizations around the world, and I divide it up by continent, at least half of them every few years when I go through and check the links are gone. And so it never occurred to me the extent to which people start these organizations and they die quickly. Now, one of the only reasons this works is that this is my retirement project. There is almost no funding for this. The council pays a few minimum expenses. They cover the cost of the WordPress website. They cover the cost of having no ads. And beyond that, there's been very little money that's changed hands. Academics are absolutely used to publishing. And these days, people understand that doing something that goes online instead of hard copy is reasonable. And you can always print these things out, so you can always show them to people and share them. Students find what we're doing, and that's worked out pretty well. I did a few years ago, because I've now been doing this since 2010, that's 14 years. A couple of years back, one of the advisory board members who's older than me said to me, what's going to happen when you die? And I basically said, I don't know. I don't want to talk about that. Don't be ridiculous. That's a horrible topic. But it was, in fact, a completely reasonable question. And so what I did is I thought about it, and I asked a few people what they would do. And I ended up with an associate director who was also getting close to retirement, and in fact retired while he was associate director, and now knows how to pick up all the pieces if I should suddenly disappear. He has access to everything. And his name is known, and he knows how to do all the parts that he needs to know how to do. One of the other things I've done is to bring in a lot of students as interns, or sometimes former students as graphic design consultant or something like that. I've done that a couple of times. I have a former student serving as graphic design consultant right now. We've done a number of posters that a former intern put together, turning some of the concepts into visual designs, and those have been downloaded thousands of times. They've been very successful people. I've had people write me and say, I put this on my door, or I put this on the department bulletin board, or I hand this out in class to start discussions. And I just got asked this fall, could I please provide these in French instead of in English by somebody in Quebec? And of course, Quebec province uses French as their dominant language. And some of the students don't know English. And so I said, if you will turn them into French, I happen to have somebody who can turn this into a visual design and do the editing necessary. So we're just about to start publishing a few of those in French. And of course, they're always open to other languages if other people want to come up with translations. So this gives you a broad image. I haven't given you much chance to ask questions.
Well, this is a good start. I mean, it's good to get the download to get the broad view of what you've been up to. And I mean, there's so many questions that I could ask. I guess one is related to your own scholarly productivity. You had mentioned to me off air that you had either recently completed or were working on a couple of books. And I'd
yes.
like to hear a little about that.
Okay. Let me tell you about five different books. I have two academic books that are both forthcoming. One is on Irving Goffman. I was at Penn overlapping with him. I had interactions with him. I was never his student. One of the things that is often said about Goffman, who was a sociologist, he died in 1982, and he is still one of the most cited sociologists in the world ever. Mm-hmm. His work influences people. When it was the 100th anniversary of his birthday a couple of years ago, people all over the world were doing all sorts of celebrations and publications. I know I was asked to give a Zoom presentation for a university in Brazil. I mean, it's just enormous. But everybody says the man was a loner. It is published over and over, and that's the word they use. He was a loner. Didn't ever do anything with other people. That didn't fit my understanding. So I ended up writing an entire book, which is going to be called Irving Goffman is Interdisciplinary Colleague, and it's going to come out with Media Studies Press, which is an open access, so it will be free, scholar-led, so it is run by academics, not some other press that makes a whole bunch of money when the academics make very little. So it's a way to share knowledge, and I'm very much interested in having the open access press. I think we need more of that. Mm-hmm. Something I discovered when I was in France in 2009, and I'm only surprised that it's taken this many years for very many options to become available in the U.S. Mm-hmm. A second book that I've co-edited is called Invisible Contrarian, and it's essays in honor of Stephen O. Murray. Steve Murray was a colleague who died in 2019, who was particularly active in an area overlapping with mine, disciplinary history, but also particularly active in terms of homosexualities around the world. And so this is a book I've co-edited with somebody else who knew him quite well, Regna Darnell, and that will be coming out with the University of Nebraska Press. I'm actually right at this moment, this is what I was doing this morning, reviewing the copy edited version of that. So that will be out early in 2025.
Nice.
But I also did three books that are not academic at all. And again, this is a thing that retirement permits you to do. One of them is a project that we started in 2013. My mother was an artist, did enormous amounts of paintings over 40 years of her career. She started in the 50s and died in the 90s. And my sisters and I ended up with boxes of her slides, of photographs, really bad 1960s photographs, professional 1980s photographs of her art. And we decided that we absolutely had to turn these into digital images that the next generation could also have, as opposed to letting them disappear in a box. Because who uses slides anymore? That was not the form anybody in the next generation wanted. And so very gradually over the last 11 years, we have taken these slides, digitized them, turned them into a book. And I wrote a biography of her, all the shows that she did, the work she did as a NASA artist, for example. We have enormous amounts of documentation, so we've taken a fair bit of that. We shared the images with the immediate family and asked who really liked which images best. We picked about 350 of them, which are in this book, which also includes a complete chronology of all of her shows, which is huge. That book has just gotten to everybody, and it's 150 pages, and I'm thrilled to have that done just for the family. It's privately published. And in addition, I decided our father really needed a book. So when I had a little time this summer, I sat down. This was much quicker. We had all his words. I had previously digitized most of them. He was a gerontologist who worked with HUD. He was one of the people who helped make Medicare happen. he was hugely involved with an enormous number of things having to do with elderly housing. He worked at HUD for decades. And so I took some of his writings. I wrote his autobiography, took some of his writings and made those accessible, and then put together as complete a bibliography of both his publications and his times he spoke before Congress. I mean, there were all sorts of things to sort out, poetry, whatever. And then the third book is A Little Nothing, which is an alphabet book made up of animal photos I took as we traveled for friends' kids. So our almost grandchildren, we don't have any actual grandchildren, but we have a grandniece and grandnephew, and we have almost grandchildren that we see fairly often in Montreal. So five books that I've managed to work on over the last couple of years. So I'm still doing some publishing.
I hope for many, many more years, even though you now have an heir apparent at the Center for Intercultural Dialogue. Does your colleague have an heir for himself?
Not yet.
We're thinking sustainability.
I think that's going to be his problem.
That becomes his problem.
Yes, I only have to find one heir. I don't have to find multiples, really.
Okay, yeah. So in terms of all this wonderful activity you've been doing, I mean, given that this program is titled Education Matters, if you were to, be the sage on the hill, speaking to us all about what you've learned from your many years of teaching and immersion in the education process in all kinds of ways, do you have any pearls of wisdom to drop?
I think it would have something to do, and it's not the most graceful phrase because I only came up with it earlier when I was talking here, but connections are huge. Making connections with other people who share your interests academically, pedagogically, and understanding the ways one connection leads to the next. That's the thing that we all can't anticipate and don't understand well enough, that the connection you make today could lead to something else interesting in a year or 5 years. So I think that's what I would say.
That's wonderful. And I would add to cultivate a kind of personhood that you, I think, exemplify, which is somebody who is very open, very friendly, a really good listener.
Evident today.
But I know you, and you can turn the table around. You're very well resourced, and you follow through. So, and you're very disciplined and diligent in maintaining your connections to other people. And, because it is a kind of work, it can be joyous work, but it is a kind of discipline. And I think you've mastered it, and you're a great example for all of us. So thank you.
Thank you. I think COVID taught all of us. COVID taught all of us that we needed to stay connected with people.
We all had to evolve in some way.
Yes.
So, Wendy, I'm so sorry we're out of time. This has been a wonderful 40 or so minutes. It's just flown by. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Wendy Leeds-Hurwitz, a Professor Emerita of Communication, University of Wisconsin-Parkside. I'm your host, Jonathan Shaler, and this has been WGTD Education Matters.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
I'm Gregory Berg, and on Monday's morning show here on WGTD, part two of my conversation with renowned composer Ricky Ian Gordon, talking about his extraordinarily candid and illuminating memoir called Seeing Through, a chronicle of sex, drugs, and opera. In this portion of the conversation, we focus on some of his most noteworthy works for the stage and his creative process. Join me for Monday's morning show beginning just after 8.
Support for WGTD comes from the Business and Professional Coalition at Carthage College, inviting employers to learn how they can keep their data secure in the age of artificial intelligence. In this free luncheon and panel discussion on Tuesday, November 12th, three Carthage alumni will share timely insights from their experience.